I don't know. That's just what pedestrian, average, mediocre receivers do. What's up? What's up? My man Deion Sanders, we all right, huh? We all right? Yeah, we all right. We gonna go to the Super Bowl again, being all right.
You're listening to the Pedestrian Podcast, the official UK podcast for the Seattle Seahawks. Here are your hosts, Ross Bell, Stuart Court, and Adam Nathan. Go Hawks!
Hello and welcome to a very special Pedestrian Podcast, the official and only UK Seahawkers podcast. As ever, myself, Stuart Court, is joined by one of the other two guys, with Ross Bell slaving away at work. Adam Nathan is here, though. How are we, sir?
I'm not bad. I've had an eventful day where I've had to buy an engagement ring, and I've just got back to my computer, and there are, I think, as many tabs as you can physically open on Firefox or whatever, looking at different wedding venues. So I'm pretty stressed, but I've got a large whiskey with me, which is cured in American barrels for our fellow guest to, you know, make him feel at home. So hopefully I'll settle down as we get into it.
Cool. Yeah, and as Adam alluded to, we are joined by a special guest on this edition of the Pedestrian Podcast. We are joined by Michael Sean Dugar, who covers our Seahawks for the Seattle PI. How are we, Michael?
I'm good. I'm good. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for working out the time difference to get me on. Appreciate it.
We massively appreciate, obviously, for you coming on what is a day off from being at VMAC with the team on a day off. So speaking for Adam, we most definitely appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. I still try to be productive on the days off. I recorded a podcast today for like an hour and wrote a story about Eddie Lacy. I'm always doing something.
Yeah. So this is your first season working the beat, isn't it? Obviously, you took over from Stephen Cohen.
Yeah.
So over here with our sports, player access appears a lot more limited and restricted to like once a week or quickly after games than it does over in the NFL. Is that the case, or is it more limited than it would appear?
Well, player access is, well, because like TV pays the bills around here, I'm not sure how it's set up over there, just because the media plays such a big role in why everyone makes so much money. The teams understand that, and they understand how important the media obligation is. Even if a guy is going to get up there like Marshawn Lynch and just say the same line 15 times in a row, because then the story ends up being Marshawn Lynch said the same line 15 times in a row, which also, you know, helps pay the bills. So we, for the most part, we can get who we want, like when we want, for the most part. There are some exceptions, you know, guys can decline, like obviously, who's a good example on the Seahawks? Trevon Boykin. So backup QB, got a bunch of legal issues going on. We could talk to him, but we probably have to agree not to ask him about, you know, violating his probation by being in a car with a girl who was drunk and backed into a bar at like 1 a.m. and injured like 7 people.
Yeah.
Well, and then if you do that interview and you don't ask about that, then you just look like an incompetent reporter, because, you know, that's what everyone wants to know about. You know, like, have they heard of Uber and Lyft and things like that?
Yeah.
So, and other than situations like that, or, you know, there was that period where Richard Sherman just hated all of us. obviously, he wasn't willing to really talk too much. But for the most part, we can get a guy back to back days, we can get him on the podium, we can get him individual stuff. It's pretty open. Just don't try to do that outside of like training camp or practices, because that, from what I understand, that might be a big no-no unless you like have a serious rapport with the player. And obviously I'm just getting started, so I don't have any of those quite yet. But I know some guys, they'll be able to like text Doug Baldwin or KJ Wright and, you know, hammer out a story if need be.
Yeah, that's good to hear about Trevon Boykin, because, you know, it's very important that backup quarterbacks, you know, we toe the line. The league wouldn't want a backup quarterback, you know, that's got issues. I'm sure something we'll allude to later on until we talk about something else. With regards to that, and you're talking about players and, you know, not wanting to rub them up the wrong way, it must be difficult when you are trying to get access, when you see things like Frank Clark had during the offseason with the female reporter, like Richard Sherman had with the media, probably the back end of last season. How hard is it to get the balancing act between siding with your colleagues, but then perhaps risking access and then vice versa? Because presumably it's a tough one to call.
Yeah, well, the in terms of well, that's another example. We're not getting Frank Clark for a while. I can probably confidently say that just because between his fish tank comment to that female reporter, and between him punching Jermaine Defetti smooth in the face during an open practice, it just, you know, and then the stuff surrounding him when he was drafted, it's just like, oh man, you know, maybe Frank shouldn't get up in front of people. We don't know what he's going to say. But me personally, I've learned that, you know, when you're on a pro beat or even a college beat, I actually learned this in college, that the people who are your colleagues on the beat they're almost more of your coworkers than like the guy who covers cops and courts for us. Now, he's a great reporter, but, you know, because I go from my house to the VMAC during this time, I haven't seen that guy in like 2 weeks. Whereas, you know, I see the guy from the Seattle Times or whatever, from King 5, I see them every day. And we sit in that room every day, and we share notes, and we ask questions to one another. And if there's some awkward conversation or some awkward question that needs to be asked, sometimes we'll all discuss how are we going to do it, or how we're all going to write this awkward piece of information. It sounds like, from what I've heard, if you guys remember a few years ago, Russell Wilson's blackness was in question.
Oh, yes.
And yes. So from what I as it stands now, I'm the only black guy in the room, in the media room. So I don't know if they would have to draw straws. I think I would just raise my hand and say, hey, I'll just ask. But I think the climate of the racial dynamic of the media room at the time left it. So, OK, which one of us middle-aged white guys is going to ask the young black guy about his blackness? You know, and that was, but they discussed it, I guess, prior to, and I think someone just took one for the team. And that's probably one of those examples too, of like, we're all there for each other, 'cause we're all doing the same job. You know, if we didn't see this play and someone else saw it, if we don't have this quote and someone else has it, for the most part, you know, we'll share, we'll work together. So when it comes like Richard Sherman, well, he hated all of us, you know, except for I think the woman who works for like the USA Today affiliate. He didn't hate her. So what she did is she pulled him to the side and said, hey, look, Richard, just come talk. It'll make this all easier. If you want, me and you can just have the first, you know, few questions to just clear everything out, so you don't get baited in anything. And then when he did talk to us during mini camp, she asked like the first 5-6 questions. He got out what he wanted to say. He tried to tell us how journalism works, which was funny. And then he went on for about another 15 minutes and answered a bunch of other stuff and kind of cleared the air. And now he's back to being himself. So like those are, I guess, the examples I can use for the Seahawks. But a lot of the time we're like a big band of typing brothers, or I guess. So obviously there's female reporters too, but you get what I'm saying. Yeah. You know, we work together to get because we all want the same thing. We want the story, and we want people to click on it and read it and subscribe, and we'll all work together to get it.
So, two part question: did you grow up as a Seahawks fan in the first place?
Not really. I was a huge Sonics fan. So, my mom was one of those parents. She got ahead of the curve. She's like, "No, my son is not playing football because football is violent." And I don't know if I necessarily thank her for that at this point, because I do enjoy playing the sport of football. But she's right. It is just guys running into each other for a few hours. So if you don't want your 8-year-old to do that, I can actually understand that decision.
I've got friends who are similar in their role for the professional soccer team that I support over here. And you may not know, but basically here, managers can just reject press conferences. Players don't give interviews after the game. It's a bit of a nightmare. And I can see in my friends that the love of the sport and the team has sort of dulled a little bit in basically having to cover the sports, where you see maybe some of the stuff that as blissfully ignorant fans we don't need or maybe even want to see. Has it impacted you at all in how you follow or support the game working so closely to it?
I kind of now have like a two-part answer. So no, like I still... like I had no problem still rooting for Wazoo while I covered Washington State University, being an alum, living in Pullman, Washington. did I have a problem covering them objectively and rooting for them? No, I was able to, you know, toe the line. Whereas my column after the game was completely just, you know, straightforward. Well, whereas like a group chat with all of my alumni friends was like full of pain and sorrow, you know, but you never knew that based on my writing because I, you know, I was at work doing my job. Yeah. The second part of that is as I've gotten closer to the game and understood just how sports work, I've kind of separated myself. Like I don't know if I necessarily like football or basketball or baseball, but I do because those are all leagues and those are like I don't know if I like the NFL, I don't know if I like MLB, or I don't know if I like NBA because those are all leagues and leagues are just at the end of the day billion-dollar corporations and it's very rare that billion-dollar corporations are not evil in their structure. So, but I do like athletes. I do like the stories and the narratives and the drama that comes with human interest that's associated with sports. If that makes sense, that I've learned to, cause if you think about the NCAA, as soon as you learn how the NCAA is structured, you're probably not going to like the NCAA because it's just this big evil corporation, billion-dollar industry that doesn't pay its workforce. And you're like, oh, well, that's kind of evil. And then you hear about some kid getting on scholarship after 3 years who was homeless before he got to that big Division I university. And like, oh, this is the greatest story ever. You kind of separate it. I like athletes. I like the stories. I like what it can do. But the industries themselves are kind of – they're run just as, you know, almost kind of flawed as a major, like, manufacturing company that makes clothes or something like that.
Yeah, so when you started working and covering the Seahawks, did you have any, like – preconceived opinions on the players and have they, if you did, have they changed by working closer with them, if closer is the right word?
I always thought Richard Sherman was super fascinating. I do remember that. I thought he was like really cool. I remember maybe a few years ago he, so I guess my preconceived notions were three guys. It was Russell Wilson, Michael Bennett, and Richard Sherman in terms of players. I remember Richard Sherman during an interview, I think on like First Take a long time ago on ESPN, he just went right at Skip Bayless.
Yeah.
I think he called him stupid, or I don't know. He pointed out that he was, you know, from Compton, California, graduated from Stanford, became an all-pro NFL player, and he was better at life. That's what he said. Yeah, he said he was better at life than him. Yeah, and I remember that's a cold line to say you're better at life than someone on their show. So I always thought he was super fascinating. I always thought Russell Wilson was a robot. I was like, does he ever not say go Hawks, like ever in his life? If he tips an Uber driver, does he say go Hawks? Like when he pays the bill at a restaurant, does he write go Hawks on the receipt? And then Michael Bennett, I just, from like the quotes that you see from him, just like you see him tweeted or like in a headline, he didn't seem very bright. He just seemed like a really funny, goofy guy who fit the stereotypical athlete, just kind of a lot of muscle and talent, but not a lot upstairs. Now, for as far as those three guys, the Richard Sherman one has kind of, it's expanded. He is fascinating, but I also realize he likes to hear himself talk. And a lot of times he probably thinks he's the smartest guy in the room, which would explain that Skip Bayless situation a lot more. Russell Wilson is indeed a robot. That was easy to confirm. And then Michael Bennett, that flipped completely. Michael Bennett is a very, very, very intelligent individual. I actually got to speak with him at a charity event that he had, I think in May, in my first 2 weeks on the job. Super intelligent guy. Probably one of the, like, you kind of can see it now. He's writing that book. His charity events are like becoming a bigger deal. He hosts a pass rushers camp in Hawaii, and you get more and more guys come in, more and more guys reaching out to him that aren't even on the Seahawks. And it's just as he's getting older and like everything circles back to the big picture for him, whether it's life after football or being a father or being a good husband or just being a man, like all his answers to everything come back to that. And that's not the guy that was perpetuated when I was like following the team from afar. Like Michael Bennett, super smart.
Yeah.
So I was the Wilson point is interesting. I was lucky enough when I was in Seattle in Wilson's first season that I just bumped into him in the Braven where he lived, and I completely fell head over heels because he just gave me 10 minutes of his time and was just incredibly nice. And it's not what you expect from sportsmen. And as the time has gone on, he's become a bit more polished and as you say, maintain that sort of robotic stance. I almost get frustrated as a fan that he's a guy who has so much exposure but doesn't actually end up saying anything in his position of interest. Does that frustrate you as a journalist? Because ultimately, you have so much time with him, and actually you don't end up getting much of interest out of him.
Well, he and Pete Carroll are interesting in that regard, because they have mastered the art of spending 2 minutes answering a question and not answering the question. It is absolutely fascinating how fantastic they are at that. With Russell in particular, I can see us from a fan perspective, but then I looked around the league and I looked at just like who the outspoken people are, who the robots are, who are the loose cannons. And if anyone is going to be that robot company man, that doesn't say much, just super positive all the time, even after he throws like 15 interceptions against Green Bay, that it be the quarterback. And, you know, that is fine. For that guy to just be basically an extension of the head coach and most of everything he says and does and the way he is in terms of his positivity, no matter what, even if it's a little cheesy sometimes, you know what? If anybody's going to be that guy, you want it to be the face of the franchise. You know, you don't want your face of the franchise writing books called Things That Make White People Upset or Uncomfortable. Now he can write that book. You know, that's fine. I think that Michael Bennett writing that book is very cool. And now if Russell did it, I don't think it would be uncool. But, you know, I think they're a lot more okay with Michael writing it than Russell writing it. I'll put it that way. So for me, it's not frustrating, but I can see how it would be, because you know he's a smart guy. You know he has causes that he cares about. You know, this is the guy that goes to the Children's Hospital every Tuesday. I don't know if he still does that, actually, but I know he was for a very long time. So, like, you know he's a good guy, but, yeah, you ask him something and it's just kind of dancing around for 5 minutes, leaves and says, go Hawks. I guess that can be kind of frustrating.
Yeah, so you mentioned Pete Carroll there, obviously, at Washington State. There's Mike Leach. That's a pretty stark contrast in how coaches approach the press and approach what they give to you, isn't it, really?
Well, Pete Carroll seems to really understand our role, and I don't think that Mike Leach does not understand our role. I just think he doesn't care. he is absolutely entitled to, and this is a guy who, you know, he's had a lawsuit, you know, with the biggest media company ever. So, I mean, I understand why he's not like thrilled about his media obligation, but I'm pretty sure he was thrilled to sign on the dotted line for that multi-million dollar contract, much of which is paid through media bonuses. But that's neither here nor there. But yeah, the contrast is crazy. But at the same time, Mike Leach, if you get to know him, I know the beat writers who cover him right now pretty well, and you know, he'll go have lunch with them or coffee, or he'll be willing to just text and just have convos about like Native Americans or gun control or whatever. But it's just like, in terms of, I think what a lot of players have realized is that the people who are there every day, like people who you see their face and you read their stuff later and you know they know what they're talking about, who are there even when the practices are like not open to the public, so that usually excludes a lot of TV people a lot of the time. They gain that respect for you. You know, they realize they know what your job is, and they know, you know what you're talking about. And I think even like a guy, both Mike and Pete, both understand that. You can just tell that a lot of the time. Well, I think Leach pretends that he doesn't want to talk to us, but then he goes on 5-minute rants about, you know, stuff like why a hot dog isn't a sandwich or something like that. And it's like, or Pokemon Go, the year that was a thing. He'll just rant about that or something. It's like, okay, you don't like us, but you know that these weird quotes are going to make you more of a star. Yeah. And like that's not an accident. So I think he's pretending a little bit. He knows what he's doing. I think he likes the attention too.
Yeah.
So we obviously follow a lot of what goes on in training camp via Twitter. And Stephen was always quite fun with the way he tweeted. And you seem to have carried on in that mantle of actually putting some personality in what you put on your tweets, which I can tell you from our point of view is certainly appreciated, especially in training camp games and whatever. Is that a company policy, or is that just smart hiring from them, just hiring the right people to sort of bring some color to what's going on?
I think it's, I don't know if it's a policy, because I know it can't be a policy for like our reporter who does, I think she does like crimes and stuff. You know, so you can't have much personality when you're reporting on sexual assault.
Yes, fair enough.
At least you shouldn't. You can, but you shouldn't. So for me, I realized that a long time ago, that that's how you establish, like, cause your readers want to know, or your listeners, whether you're a radio guy, they want to know who you are. Just that, you know, you don't want to make everything about you, but you know, especially during practice, you know, practice is pretty, I'm serious when I need to be, when I'm reporting on something like domestic violence, sexual assault, or, you know, but then so football is allows for a lot of comical moments, you know, or just some funny commentary between whether it's the fans or just the music that's playing, especially with a team like the Seahawks, who are really good and the fans are really engaging, and you know, everything is real light around the organization until someone punches someone in the face or drag races on the way home from practice. I you guys remember that, right? That was,
yeah,
was it Marshawn and Fred Jackson?
Yeah.
Like, It's just real light and fun right here, but I've always wanted to, when I got on Twitter, I was always like that. I've toned it down a little bit, you know, cut down on profanities because I want to, you know, be able to pay the light bill, but, that's strategic on my part. I like having fun, on there because, you know, I don't know how your guys' timelines look, but mine's like 80% jokes on my timeline. Unfortunately, they come even when there's a serious topic, but there's just jokes just everywhere, and it's just a lot of lighthearted stuff. So I like to report on it that way too, and it gives that personality that people want. And for me, I think I have what, 2,000 followers, 2,000 and some change, right? And then I think Seattle Times guy has like 148,000 or something, or maybe it's just 48,000, but it's an exponentially larger number than mine. And because he works for a bigger outlet, that's just how that's going to be. Same thing with the ESPN guy, the Tacoma guy. So could I somehow get that following? Maybe, but I don't know if I need to beat my voice to be as loud as long as it's different. So if you offer that unique perspective, I'm a lot younger than a lot of these guys too. That helps and it hinders, but that's strategic in my regard too. I know my voice will never be as loud as the Seattle Times, but if it's different, then I can attract a unique audience in that way too.
I mean, I really enjoyed seeing 8 tweets in a row of slant to Jermaine Kearse, and then you saying in there, football's supposed to be fun, but tackling Eddie Lacy looks like 0% fun, or something of that ilk. So keep doing you, because I enjoyed that.
Yeah. Oh man, tackle these one guy. I thought I get off topic real quick. Marcus Cromartie. I don't know how much he weighs, but he probably should weigh a lot more after Monday. Because my goodness, he tried to tackle Eddie, I think it was him, tried to tackle Eddie Lacy, and he just bounced off that dude like a little kid on like a getting tossed off a mechanical bull. It was insane. Eddie just kept running right through him. And I thought, that looks so, even the big guys, you know, even backup defensive tackles are just bouncing off of him. And I was thinking, man, this is why my mom didn't want me to play, because that looks like that hurts, you know?
So like, I think I'd rather get hit by a
hammer. That looks like a lot of pain.
Yeah. Also, yeah. I think obviously Jordan Simone had a rough few days, which you highlighted as well, when he'd go up against Jimmy Graham.
Oh, yeah. I don't know why the team was. I guess that's just how it pans out, because the first team offense goes against like the reserves a lot of time in those team periods. But it's just how the scheme requires Jordan Simone. Like, what part of the scheme, right, in the film room where the coordinator's like, hey, Jordan, if Jimmy does this, you follow him. And it's like, coach, that's Jimmy Graham. I went undrafted out of Arizona State. And it's just like, do what you got to do. And it's just like, okay, sure. And you wonder why there's a touchdown every time that happens. And, you know, it's so unfair to Jordan. And then, you know, he gets cut, but he got cut on Sunday. It's like, well, he got cut. Because you had him going against this all-pro tight end in practice. He was getting worked. And I felt bad for him, too, because he went to Wazoo, I think, for a year, too.
Yeah.
I believe he did. Yeah, so I feel, yeah, that's messed up. If the scheme requires that, change the scheme, man. That's he deserved a little better than that.
So obviously it's a week into camp, or 8 or 9 days. A few different things have occurred. Obviously the main one come out during the first practice, I think it was. Have you known a situation like the one with Malik McDowell where there is absolutely nothing coming out which appears concrete, or what happened, or his injury status? And is it an easy thing to work around when there's so little information available?
Usually in a situation like this, I think there would be like ways to find some sources, and I think they would come from the family. But because the family has because, you know, the kid gets all the media training he wants, but his little cousins don't know not to tell ESPN things. So yeah. So they'll spill the beans, or, you know, an uncle, you know, like, oh, ESPN's calling. Yeah. What do you want to know? But because the family has requested a certain level of privacy in this regard, I think that's why we're not seeing many leaks, other than right when we found out that, oh, it might have been an ATV accident. Usually I think we get anonymous sources all the time. I know Richard Sherman doesn't believe in those, but they are real, and they are valuable, incredible in a lot of regards. But the Malik one is interesting because they're not even, it doesn't sound like they're telling the team much. There's not even going to be a lot of leaks out of there. That doesn't mean that someone will sniff something out, because I think, someone will. But this Malik situation is pretty tough, because the details that even Pete Carroll's given us, they just don't add up. You know, Malik has a concussion, but he feels fine, but he can't do any physical work, but he can walk. And it's what? And but you let him fly back to Michigan.
Yeah.
So he feels fine enough that you didn't want to, it's no point of him being around the building. You know, he shouldn't be in the film room. He shouldn't be with the coaches, nothing, but he feels fine. But you don't think you're going to have him this year, or you're not even sure. So this whole thing just doesn't make any sense. Once all the details come out, it'll all be so clear, and like, oh, this is why this was happening. But for now, it's just a big head scratcher. So this guy, you know, is this guy concussed? Does he know where he's at right now? Apparently, he can tweet. So we don't know what's this one is weird. This is a weird one. Even in my few years of experience, this is odds, because the family is so openly involved in keeping it hush.
I'm pretty cynical about a lot of stuff, and we were talking on our show last week that it's unfortunate that with the reputation he has, he's going to get tarred with a brush of, well, he's done something wrong. It seems to me that eventually this stuff always comes out, and the team and maybe the family aren't necessarily helping themselves by making it so convoluted. Is that a general thought, or is that just me talking nonsense?
When I was thinking about it, when we were doing our podcast a few days ago, Seahawks Man to Man, it was just, I think you get the sense maybe the team, the family is trying to protect someone else who might have been involved. So they're whether that's another player, which I don't think it was, but maybe a family member or someone else. Maybe they were, I don't know, maybe they're doing something they weren't supposed to be doing, like in terms of legally. Maybe they're protecting something else there. Because, I mean, we found out dude from the Giants blew his fingers off pretty quick. And that's a lot dumber than being on an ATV. So I don't want to, I mean, you could look at it pretty cynically, like, oh, did our top pick just break his face? Maybe. We don't know. But looking at it that way, maybe something else is going on with another person is involved. Because I've been reading a lot of reports, and I don't think I've had anyone say confidently that Malik was riding an ATV, or he was the one operating. So did someone crash into him? There's that too. We just know ATV accident. You know, was he the one riding it? Was he, you know, was he on the back of someone else's? Was he standing next to someone? And they crashed into him, or was he stationary on his own? Someone crashed into him. He hurt his face. Maybe that's why he didn't have a helmet on. Maybe, you know, there's just so much we don't. And because if someone was in the wrong, protecting them would make a lot of sense in terms of not revealing the details.
Yeah. So he tried to tackle Eddie Lacy, and he thought it was on the TV from the size of a hit.
You know, I would not blame him, because Eddie Lacy is just it's like a washing machine with legs.
Similar width.
It's just brutal. Yeah, it's brutal.
So what is your read as it stands on McDowell with regards playing this year? Obviously, that's a big question everyone wants. Do you think we'll see him on the field this year, or do you think they've already ruled that out from the little bits you can pick up on?
I don't think they've ruled it out, but it sounds the word I've been using confidently, like even writing in my stories, is doubtful. It doesn't sound like he'll be that back this year at all. Just because of how just dark it sounds. It's just, yeah, he hurt himself, multiple injuries, yeah, concussion. We don't know if he'll be back this year. Well, yeah, why should we think he will be? Doesn't sound like Because like when the team wants to be unjustly optimistic, I guess I'll call it, they do it. You know, they take those opportunities to do it. This time they are not.
Yeah.
So that allows us to say, this is pretty bad. I think I'm divulging a little bit of behind the scenes info here. We took like a media like pool of like when Malik would be back, and I don't know if anyone picked 2017. I know I picked like 2018, like rookie minicamp or something, or maybe the OTAs. Uh-huh. that he'll be back. It doesn't sound good. You know, if you read the quotes, uh-huh. you watch how Pete says it, nothing sounds good other than the one time he said he feels fine. Well, then you just said he can't do any physical workouts and he may have a concussion. What part of that? I've had a concussion before. I didn't feel fine at all. So, you know, and I was in an actual car accident. I got hit by a truck and I was in a small Pontiac, you know. So if he feels fine, yeah, that's cool. But it's just hard to believe when you let him fly back to Michigan. You don't even want him around, or he doesn't want to be around either way.
Yeah. Pete, for me, is the most illuminating, because he often in a post-game press conference will be like, yeah, he got dinged up, he got banged up, and it'll be like a four-week injury. So for him to actually say there's a problem, that makes it seem to me like there's a serious problem with regards to his status for the rest of the season.
Yeah, because Pete likes to just say what where the injury happens. Like, yeah, he's got a bit of a knee, or he's got an ankle. Which, like, grammatically, I hate typing that stuff up, because it's like, well, I know he has an ankle, Pete. Matter of fact, I know he has two. But what happened to the one that allowed him, that required he be carried off the field? Anytime Pete and Russell Wilson aren't optimistic about something, it's bad. Yeah. Because these guys are optimistic about everything. So if they don't sound very good about Malik, then it's probably not very good.
Yeah, so are the camps as intense on the field as they appear? And obviously Peter King last week said, was quite open and quite quick to pump the intense and maybe overstepping the mark at certain times. Obviously that was compounded with what happened with Jermaine Fairley and Frank Clark, I think the day after Peter King wrote that. But are the camps as intense? Obviously there's alpha males is often used with the Seahawks. Is it accurate?
In the short time I've been here, I follow the NFL pretty close, at least around this time, because I'm always interested in training camp fights. So it doesn't seem like it's unlike what's going on everywhere else. Which is why Richard Sherman, in his like in denouncing that ESPN article, the one about the locker room discord, the part he harped on the most and tried to refute was the notion that because he told Wilson he effing sucked, that there was some dysfunction, and he kept saying, well, that's the case everywhere. And I thought that was important, that he's right. I think a few years ago, didn't Josh Norman like fight Cam Newton?
Yeah.
Like he hit the franchise quarterback. That's way more dysfunctional than just telling the quarterback he sucks. I mean, you hit the franchise? Yeah. Imagine if someone hit Russell Wilson in the face. Like he's going to jail. Forget just getting sent to the locker room. The fans might arrest him. Citizens arrest. Like that's like putting it in perspective there. Like the Frank thing going over the top, punching him in the face. Yeah. Do I think that there'd be more punching in the face at camps if guys happen to be on the field without a helmet on? Absolutely. I don't get why guys try and punch people when they do have helmets on. That's stupid. But like that's why Richard Sherman, when he was talking about it, I think Monday, he said, yeah, you shouldn't be like, he didn't justify it this way, but in his explanation, he said the line, you should never be on the field with a helmet on, or with the helmet off, rather. And because he's right, because that's when you get punched in the face and it'll hurt. Otherwise, it's just a bunch of mushing and shoving, which that's absolutely normal. So, I mean, are the Seahawks intense? Of course. But in terms of crossing the line and like pushing the boundary from now, it doesn't seem like anything crazier than anything else that's like any of the other extreme examples that have happened in the league. Didn't Geno Smith get his jaw broken? By a teammate over like over
Impala or something, signed by Rich Ryan the year later.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously these are all extreme examples, and they are over the line. Josh Norman hit Cam, and forget who hit Geno, and obviously Frank hit Jermaine. Again, those were two quarterbacks getting hit. Like, that's more over the line than anything else, hitting the quarterback, because he's more valuable than you. And in almost every scenario, unless you're J.J. Watt, the quarterback is more valuable than you. Like, even if he's not very good, he's more valuable than you. So, like, are the Seahawks intense? Yeah. Do they go over the top? Yeah. Does it seem like it's much different than anywhere else? Not really. At least not right now. Not when we got quarterbacks with broken jaws over what, gambling debts?
Yeah. I'm just pleased if Eddie blocked something. I mean, it may have been his face with a punch, but you know, if he can take that into stunts off the outside against Tampa Bay, I'll be delighted.
Well, the jokes about him not being able to block in my Twitter mentions after I tweeted that he got punched in the face were showed the comical side of Twitter, and then the domestic violence jokes that I also got in my mentions showed the very dark and disturbing side of Twitter. And yeah, that was so, he hit him so hard. That was bad.
Did you see it?
Oh, yeah. I was maybe 20 yards from it, which is pretty close considering like where the action happens. I saw start to finish. I saw Jermaine standing there, saw Frank take a good like 4 or 5 steps before he made contact. Like it was bad. You know, he laid on the ground for a very long time because, you know, Frank is big.
Sorry, Michael. Just tell us about it a bit, because we've not actually heard anything about what happened. And it'd be quite interesting to know how it started and whatnot. Because as far as I'm concerned, Frank Clark flew across a line and hit a Fetty with his helmet on. But I have no idea what happened.
Oh, okay. Here we go. Let's see. So they're doing it's just a normal offensive line versus defensive line, this blocking drill. Rodney Coe, defensive tackle, who oddly enough was added to the roster because Malik McDowell didn't report. So maybe this is all Malik's fault. I'm joking. But Rodney Coe was engaged with Will Perikak. I hope I'm saying his name right. They were engaged. And I think it just went too beyond the whistle. And I can't remember who forced the issue, but I know they ended up tumbling over a water cooler. And that just started like a fight. It started like a full-on offensive lineman versus defensive lineman brawl, like Royal Rumble wrestling-style brawl. Everyone's just pushing, shoving. There's some other punches being thrown, too, but everyone has their helmets on at this point, so it's kind of counterproductive. Like Pete runs over, Cam Chancellor, like everyone, the whole team now sees, oh, there's a big brawl going on with like a third of the team. It's all the third of the biggest guys on the team, too. So let's go see what's going on. The dust kind of settles for a little bit. There's still some jaw-jacking going on. And at that point, Ed now lost his helmet, and he is standing just kind of off to the side a little bit. I think he's chirping at Frank, and that's when Frank just runs, takes about 4 or 5 steps, and just cocks back his right arm very far, windmill style, and just connects with Effetti's face. And Effetti just drops. And just, he's just on the ground, face down for a little bit. Trainers flip him over. They're looking at him, talking to him. He's being evaluated. He was down long enough for me to see that he was down, tweet that he was down, look back up, and he was still down. respond to some tweets. Like he was down for a while in tweet time, I guess if that's a thing. And eventually he got up and got helped to the locker room.
So is there Frank Clark on the phone to Conor McGregor to be his new sparring partner for the next few weeks?
Oh, I mean, from what I'm reading about the fight, I don't have much interest in watching that fight. But wow, I mean, no. Yeah, maybe he could use a partner there, because whoo, Frank. I don't want to condone violence, but man, and he. Especially because Frank's got a history of alleged domestic. Yeah. I don't even know if it's alleged at this point, but I'll use the word to protect myself from a job. He's got a history of alleged domestic violence, so it's like, ooh, boy. Yeah, you hit him. Really. Jermaine and Faye's like 6'5".
Yeah.
He just dropped, you know? Didn't who hit Richard Sherman? Trent Williams?
Yeah.
Didn't Trent Williams from the Redskins just smack Richard Sherman in the face? Richard didn't even like stumble.
Flinch,
you know,
yeah.
And Richard's wiry. And yeah, it's like Frank is a strong man, unfortunately, I guess, in this regard.
Yeah.
So on offensive line matters, if Eddie seems to be playing some sort of game of bingo of trying to piss off every single individual defensive lineman over the last 2 years, because I think he's had Bennett.
Bennett Averill.
I think he's doing pretty well in terms of his numbers. But can he actually play, and what are his chances at right tackle? Because I have to say, I'm not optimistic.
There's not much reason to be optimistic from the outside looking in. I will add Richard Sherman to that list of people he apparently has tried to piss off, if you recall from that same ESPN article. I felt bad for Richard Sherman in that regard, because, I mean, if Effetti hit him clean with no helmet, he's going down. I think. Is he going to be a good right tackle? Is anybody on the Seahawks line going to be good? I mean, who can confidently say yeah, right? I mean, yeah. Other than Tom Cable, right? I mean, and he'll always say yeah, as he should. The coach should never – I don't think the coach should be critical of people to the – I'm one of those people. I think go ahead and praise him in front of us. Chew him out in private, you know, unless you know that chewing him out publicly will be effective. You guys have that relationship. I'm one of those people. But I can't confidently say anyone's going to be – even Justin Britt, I can't even say confidently he's going to – he's going to be good, you know. Can't say George Fant will be world better just because there's nowhere to go but up. But even if he does go up, how far, you know, how good is up for a guy who played, what, 7 or 8 snaps at, of that position maybe before his rookie year protecting Russell Wilson? So from what I've gathered personality-wise, Jermaine's on the wrong side of the ball in terms of trash talking. Like at the University of Idaho, their football team, the defense was called the Dark Side. It sounds – I don't know if they have a name for it other than the Legion of Boom over here. But if they do, Jermaine probably needs to be over there in terms of how much he talks, because it's like it's because in my understanding just of the nature of the two positions, the defensive ends talk more because they get to run at other people. And for the most part, they get to punch you, not punch like for real punch. But they just hand it. There's a reason they do so much hand-to-hand combat work. In terms of, you know, the D-line does, because they get to use their hands and they mostly get to slap you in the head. So they're the ones that get to do more talking. You're kind of like you're in the reactionary state, so you don't really get to talk much. Like if you're an offensive lineman, what are you going to say? Come at me? Well, he will, and he'll slap you, and then he'll go tackle the quarterback, and then you look bad. So if Fetty is a trash talker like I've heard, then yeah, he's on the wrong side of the ball. And if he doesn't really progress as a right tackle as they hope he will, then he also is on the wrong side of the ball.
What would be your offensive line for the what would you pick, and B, what do you expect the offensive line to be for the first game in Green Bay? Because we've all chipped in quite a lot over the summer with regards to this, and none of them look pretty. I'm not going to lie, but you know, maybe you've got a different complexion on it than us.
I expect to make it. I think so from left to right, I think your season opener at Green Bay will probably be left to right: George Fant, Luke Jokel, Justin Britt, Odey Obusi, and Jermaine Ifedi.
That's why I left.
So I think really the only spot up for grabs, honestly, is either Obusi or Glowinski, at least right now. Mark Glowinski, that is. That's probably the only spot I see really up for grabs at the moment. Now, if it was up to me, if I was constructing an offensive line, I'd have paid a lot of money for offensive tackles and guards in the first round of the draft, in the second round of the draft, in the third round of the draft, and I would have drafted guys who played football other than just, you know, a week ago, and I would have acquired guys who weren't open box specials, and I guess I'll explain open box specials. You know, if you buy something from a store and it's like refurbished, like someone else has already bought it, used it, didn't like it, brought it back. Seahawks love doing those. I would avoid those completely. That Luke Jokel would be an example of one of those. Number 2 overall pick. Jacksonville said, you're not very good. Let you go. Seahawks are like, cool, we'll give you $8 million. It's like, wait, what? I would avoid those. So that would, I don't know who I think should be on the O-line, but like, the way they've put it together, it's like, let's build the cheapest, youngest offensive line possible, and let's hope Russell Wilson stays healthy. And then in 2016, that just blew up in their face. And they had tried to address it. Obusi's a veteran, and he's not young, and he is cheap still. But Luke's not incredibly young, and he wasn't incredibly cheap, but he's an open box special. See why I can't say confidently anyone's going to be any good? It's just I don't really know what the plan is here. It's like, I know John Schneider tried to justify it after the draft, kind of explaining it. He's like, yeah, well, you know, we paid a lot of other positions. You know, the one that took a hit was offensive line. I was like, I guess maybe if that's your reasoning, because if you're going to invest in a franchise QB, then you therefore need to invest around him.
Yes.
So like, yeah, I understand. You had to pay Bobby. You had to pay KJ. You had to pay Michael, and you had to pay Richard and Cam and Earl. Sure, I get it. You should also pay a left tackle because you paid Russell. Like, that should be a ripple effect, I guess. You pay Russell, so you pay someone to keep him off his butt. Like, that would be my logic. But, you know, start a power forward there. You know, whatever works.
I'm already dreading Jari Evans having an amazing game for Green Bay on opening day against us when he should be our right guard and should have been for the last year and a half.
Yeah, and the Seahawks don't like to. It doesn't, like I said, they want to keep it cheap. Now they're the way they handle contract stuff, for the most part, depending on how you feel about Jermaine Kearse, has been done pretty well. And I say Jermaine because for some reason he's like the most hated Seahawk on the team, which is very, very strange considering he has he has three of the most important catches in franchise history, probably. I would think, right? NFC, both NFC title games, and then he catches the ball with his teeth basically to set up that sets up the interception that Russell threw in Super Bowl 49. So I don't know why he's hated. But yeah, depending on how you feel about his contract, the way they handle contracts and the money and negotiations and paying people they need to but not going bankrupt in doing so, that does need to be praised, except for when it comes to the O-line. Other than that, that's like the asterisk there. So yeah, the offensive line, I can see why anyone on the outside looking in is pessimistic, because you really have no reason, you know, to be optimistic.
Cool. So a couple of names I've popped up over the weekend at camp, both rookies in Chris Carson and Quill Griffin. First on Griffin, he was possibly the draft pick I was most excited about when we initially drafted him. I said to Adam and Ross on the last episode that I think he'll be starting opposite Sherm at some point this season. Is that an easy path for him to take as he looks currently, or is it Jeremy Lane's job for the foreseeable?
So the way they did that depth chart wise was very strange. So for the first few days of camp, the starting defensive backfield was, when they're in nickel defense, was Cam, Earl, Sherman, Nico Thorpe, and Jeremy Lane. So Jeremy Lane went down. I think he has a soft tissue issue, I believe. When that happened, the new defensive backfield in the nickel, the first team, was Cam, Earl, Sherman, Shaquille Griffin, and DeAndre Elliott, with Nico Thorpe completely healthy, just running with the backups, which is very strange to see. It's like, can Nico only play with Jeremy? I'm not really sure how that works. Because, like, yeah, Shaquille had been getting praised, like, heavily from everyone the whole time, but even then he was still not primarily a starter. And then all of a sudden Jeremy goes down, and, you know, the guy who was starting at nickel as is goes and they insert Shaquille. So it sounds like they expect Shaquille to be, you know, good at that spot, expecting to be ready. The problem is, even if you do have the talent at that position, you need to be ready for being the mark. You need to be ready for being the weak link, the target, because if I'm a quarterback and I drop back, well, I only have about a half a second to think, because here comes Michael Bennett, and I can't run to my other side because here comes Frank Clark. And I can't really just check it down over the middle because there's Bobby Wagner. And I can't throw it to over there because there's Richard Sherman, Cam Chancellor, and Earl Thomas. So you are my only option, my smart option. I'm going to go at you. And he needs to be ready to be that guy. And to ask that of a rookie is tough. Now, not to say that he won't be able to handle something like that, but that's going to make it tough. So let's say even if he gets some first team burn in the first two or three preseason games, like, how well is he going to hold up with teams dropping back and saying, well, they've got a rookie over there and all pro over there, so you know where we're going, and can he handle that? So can he get the spot? Yeah, sure. Anybody can. Everything's up for grabs. Can he hold it?
Yeah.
That'll be really important.
Yeah.
In terms of the nickel that you talked about, I look at the linebacker core and I see two superstars, and then, not to be harsh on them, sort of a bunch of guys that will be great on special teams. do you expect that they might bring someone in, or there's a Sam linebacker there that you can see, or are we just going to be lined up in nickel because that's the way the NFL seems to be going?
I think they like Michael Wilhoit, and you know, bringing back Mike Morgan does, like, it helps. They like Terrence Garvin as well, so I think they realize that that position, they're not going to be utilized much. I can't remember the percentage of snaps they were in nickel. Somewhere like 60 or 70, maybe. It was a lot where they only had just KJ and Bobby on the field. So I think I can't imagine them bring someone in. I mean, they could, because this team, you know, preaches compete. Maybe because it rhymes with the coach's name or not, I don't know. But they do. So, you know, I'd never say never in terms of bringing more talent in, but I don't think they want to heavily invest in that position, which is part of why they brought Mike Morgan back. So especially with a trade to get DJ Alexander, they love that good special teams guys. So yeah. I just did my 53-man roster projection. It ran yesterday. I think my six linebackers were Bobby, KJ, Terrence Garvin, Michael Wilhoit, DJ Alexander, and Mike Morgan. If one of those guys doesn't make it, they bring someone in, I wouldn't be too shocked. But right now, I feel pretty confident in that being the six that makes the 53-man in September.
Yeah. So with obviously the other guy, the rookie who stood out, is Chris Carson. Does he have a chance of being like this year's Thomas Rawls, Pete Carroll? You seem to be a Pete Carroll pet as a draft pick. Obviously, Rawls wasn't drafted. Is that a path that you see him taking as well? Like, just sneaks on and then makes the most of his opportunities when they come in Carson?
Well, I think running backs should just always be optimistic, because the guys ahead of you, you know, the play doesn't end until someone hits them. And that, you know, it's a violent sport. So your chances are you're going to get a shot, you know?
Yeah.
So, right now I'd say Chris is battling with Alex Collins to get that fourth spot. So I think they'll carry four running backs: Thomas, Eddie, and CJ Procise. So can Chris grab that fourth spot? Yeah, that's what the preseason is for. Preseason is for things like Chris Carson or Alex Collins. The preseason is designed for that. Well, and to make money, but it's in terms of like talent evaluation. It's designed for guys like that to duke it out for spots that we don't think matter. And next thing you know, three guys are all out for various reasons. And, oh, wait, we need our seventh round pick to lead us to a win against, like, Atlanta or something. So I give Chris a fair shot. Before camp started, I gave him maybe a 7% shot. Now I'd say that's like a 35% shot of grabbing a roster spot. Dramatic improvement. And then after maybe two preseason games, it's up to 55. So you never know.
Yeah. So is there anyone else who's stood out to you who isn't getting much, like, column inches or people talking about it, but is there anyone else who we should look out for in the preseason games coming?
I think Amara Darbo has been really good, the receiver out of Michigan.
Yeah.
He's looked really good. Where he's really excelled is in the one-on-one stuff against the DBs, which they didn't get to do a lot of in OTAs and minicamp, which I don't think you can, which I think is why they didn't. He's been really good in training camp, but the problem is when it comes to like stuff like the team periods, his quarterback play hasn't been very great, and he's already in a run heavy system, so it hasn't had a lot of opportunities. But I think he'll be really good. Like if he gets any reps, I don't see a world. I don't know how they'll divide up the teams and the situations, but if he gets some reps with Russell Wilson, you know, in a couple some quality drives, I think he'll be able to stand out. He's a guy I'm pretty sure will make the team as one of the six receivers. Cyril Grayson has had some really good catches. The track star at LSU, he's had some good moments. And the thing is with the rookies, they've had to, or the new guys, or anyone playing with the twos or the threes, they've had to make great catches because, again, backup quarterback play hasn't been out. It's shaky. That's the safe word I'll use there.
Yeah, so on Darbo, as we said, Wilson and Pete don't really give much away, but that was one example of Wilson kind of like giving a glimmer, because last week he name dropped Darbo unprompted twice in pretty quick succession, so that caught my attention for sure.
You mentioned the backup quarterback play, and I think I said on our podcast, if when the deal went through, Austin Davis is just pissing money up the wall for no reason. And I'm going to stand by it because, you know, I'm nothing if not, you know, forthright in my views. In relation to that and sort of transitioning into the topic of the year, is there anything that you see in these two quarterbacks that would make you think they should be on the roster ahead of Colin Kaepernick?
Oh, goodness, no. Not ahead of, I thought you were going to say just on the roster. Yeah, I'm going to say, yeah, sure. Ahead of Colin, no. That's just pretty clear. I mean, I'm not one of the people who subscribes to the black ball theory with Colin, only because I think black ball implies a level of collusion or an element of collusion, I guess, that I just don't think I don't think there was like a conference call with all the GMs and the owners that said, hey, let's keep Colin out. I think the structurally, how this goes back to the evil billion-dollar corporation thing I talked about, structurally, they didn't need a conference call because they're all programmed to think the same way. It's this guy and what he represents disrupts the status quo. So we do not want that here. And I think, so like, is he being blackballed? I don't think so. Cause that, yeah, like I said, that's an active thing. I think this is just the structure of the organizations, doesn't allow for someone like him to be on a team. You know, and the NFL has shown us its true colors in that way plenty of times. You know, there's plenty of guys who get put on rosters and teams and plenty of guys who get praised. You know, you look at like, okay, I don't want to mess up any examples right now, but like the way Ray Lewis is like praised, or even a Marvin Harrison getting in the Hall of Fame. Marvin Harrison is in the Hall of Fame and Terrell Owens is not because he's a bad teammate. Marvin Harrison might have killed a guy, and Terrell Owens, was maybe a jerk. Well, not maybe a jerk. He was, you know, in a locker room problem. Meanwhile, found a murder weapon out near a place that, a business that Marvin Harrison owns. But like, the NFL showed us its true colors in that way. So in terms of like Colin, like, is he being blackballed? I don't think so. But do I think that teams are certainly scared? Well, yeah, you saw the Ravens went and asked, Ray Lewis. They listened to input from like their fans. Well, why did you do that? Because it's not strictly football. Like, how often do you consult the fans on football matters? Like, are the fans getting consulted when you want a free agent, you know, will linebacker? No, they're not. Because you don't care what the fans think, because you get paid to make the football decisions. But they consulted fans and outside people because they know it's not just a football decision. And I don't think anything, like, I don't know if there was anything more telling than that right there with how the Ravens handled it and it admittedly going outside for an opinion on that. Like, I think a lot of the football people wouldn't mind calling on the team. I don't think Pete would. I don't think John Harbaugh would. I don't think a lot of coaches or general managers would, because they're concerned. They know they get fired when they don't win games. And if they feel someone's going to help them win games, then that's fine. They're not the ones who have to sit around with their rich buddies if they're an owner and you know, and have to talk about why they hired the guy who, you know, disrespected America. Where meanwhile, the coaches are probably worried about, hey, can he throw? Sure, bring him in. And then, because that's all their concern. You know, you get fired when you don't win. So that's their concern. Now, in terms of Trevon and Austin, I don't want to make it seem like I'm just slamming them because they're not Colin, but like, just objectively speaking, yeah, the play has been shaky. I mean, I was texting one of our friends yesterday. I was like, yeah, he's a Seahawk fan. So yeah, they should just call Colin now. I wouldn't even wait till a preseason game. You know, Austin Rivers, Austin Davis didn't look great in the scrimmage. Trevon Boykin hasn't looked fantastic, and you can tell, you know, Pete spills his guts when he talks about some of these guys. You ask him about seventh round pick Chris Carson, he'll go on for 2 minutes. You ask him about the quarterback play, it's like, oh, I don't know, I haven't had him much. Got a bad look at the film. No, you don't. you know exactly how you feel about your QBs. You just couldn't think of a politically correct way to say it before before we after we asked you the question. So you gave us that. So I mean, that's telling right there. We had that example just now. I can't remember. How he talked about Malik. Yeah, same thing. How he doesn't talk about Trevon. How he doesn't talk about Austin. They both did some good things, quote unquote. Yeah, sure. You'd say that if they threw three picks. So, like, the backup quarterback situation is pretty shaky. Hopefully Russ stays healthy, because it doesn't look great if he doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, this certainly seems like something that if someone had just signed Kaepernick in June, there would have been another story by then, and they could have buried it, but whatever. So you mentioned you're a Wazoo fan, and we do like to sort of venture into the college game a little bit here, and we do a drafting Seahawks thing. I think that Wazoo have a quarterback that, come the end of the year, is going to be one of the sort of late spoken about guys that really goes up in a lot of people's estimations in Luke Falk, who I think is an archetypal, really good quarterback. And he strikes me as certainly a better college quarterback than Jared Goff, for goodness sake. Is he a guy that you expect big things out of in his NFL career?
Luke, that's a good question. You know, I'm not sure, because it's just the way the air raid is perceived, I think, by the NFL. Maybe it's one of those gimmicky things that's hard to transfer over to the pro game. But it's like, well, look how many people are in shotgun now. And, you know, I'm not 100% sure. It's tough. But I do know that, speaking of Jared Goff, by the way, anyone who went to Wazoo knew that was a bad idea as a first pick. scratch that. Anyone who watched rooted for a Pac-12 team knew that, wait a minute, the Rams did what? Oh, that was bad.
Unless you're Michael Silver, like, who got the guy drafted.
Yeah, I mean, you guys should have me on for a whole another day to talk about just the lead up to the draft and how silly it is and all the code words we use and how people talk them into spending millions of dollars on people that they know aren't very, very good. But going back to Luke, you know, I think, like, from a mental standpoint, he can definitely have a successful career, and he can have some success because I didn't know that this about the air raid, just how many plays are built into each play call. I think it's like four or five are built into, like, when he gets a call, it's basically him making the rest of the calls, and he has all these decisions to make at the line and who goes where and what to do. And like, he's an offensive coordinator on the field too. That's what's required of an air raid quarterback. And that just goes to the decision making process. And, like, you look at how efficient he is and how mistake free he can be. I think he had a game where he only, like, threw four incompletions last year. Like, those type of qualities, I think, will translate. Now there's just a matter of, you know, having the arm strength. His arm strength is going to get torn to shreds by draft analysts, because they have to tear something to shreds, and they have to like, big something up. So that'll be Luke's problem. But I think in a system that's going to, like, tailor to his, like, strengths, maybe be like a team who, like, knows they need a franchise QB and they'll draft one for that reason, then yeah, I think Luke could have some success in that regard.
So last one for me, we every year in our group, there's a huge group trip to Seattle for a game. We've done, what did we do last year? We did the Buffalo Bills Monday night
Buffalo
game. Year before we did Carolina, year before that was Oakland. Stuart and I are actually going to the Giants game in New York this year. We can't make it to Seattle. But if there's one bar and one restaurant and one site you can give our listeners to tell them to go to on their weekend away, where would they be in Seattle?
For a game or just to hang out?
Game weekend. They've got the whole weekend there. Let's say they're going from Thursday to Monday. The game day's sorted. Where can they go on a non-game day?
Okay. This is going to be tough, because I host a lot of things at my house, so I tend not to go out on game days much. But I know Art Marble downtown Seattle. That's good for a non-game night.
Yeah, let's talk non-game day. Not just on the Saturday before the game.
Oh yeah. So if you're that's a bar. It's called Art. I think it's called Art Marble 21 is the official name. That's a fun place to go, and that's a place you can go, like, either it's just you and a bunch of your buddies, or let's say there's some women in the group. And you want to make it a date type thing, because they have, like, that's a place that they have, like, what's it called? Like, skee ball and, like, yeah, ping pong, air hockey. You can make a fun thing out of it. I don't know, go guys against girls, stuff like that. What was the other one? Was that, like, a site? You want to know a site to go see? What time of it? Because if you come in, like, September and it's kind of hot, I'd say go to Alki Beach. But if you come in December, don't leave your hotel because it's freezing.
I was there for the Super Bowl parade, and I've never been as cold in my entire life.
Oh, man, I missed the Super Bowl parade. I was out at Wazoo. I was really disappointed in that. Side note. Where else is good? I would say anywhere in Mount Baker, just right on the water, like even there, like Mount Baker area, Seward Park, those areas are good. Even when it's like cold out, just because the water here is just like, even when you're on it, it's cold. It's just kind of beautiful. Whether it's like at night and you can see stars, or even though it's a nice day and you see people, you know, out there on their boats, you know, it's just beautiful scenery. And you'll feel like you're in somewhere other than where you're from more often than not. Like that's a big thing. Like I tell you some touristy stuff, but every town's got like touristy kind of cheesy stuff.
Yeah.
But when you're standing there right on Lake Washington, you know, you kind of feel, you know what? I'm in Seattle, yeah. which is pretty important.
When we were out there last year, the guys we were like staying with, they took us, is it Kerry Park in Queen Anne? With the view of the space at night, and one of the guys who was over there with us, I think so. It's the view of the needle and everything at night, and obviously it was in November, so luckily it was a clear night, and it was just, the view was just incredible. It was like a postcard view for eyes, but that's just back to what you say about there's little views that aren't touristy. But that was one of them. That was absolutely breathtaking when we turned the corner and saw the Space Needle. It just looked like it was 5 yards away when it was half a mile away, kind of thing. I know
what you're talking about. Yeah, you know, it's funny. I actually went there for the first time in my life. I'm 25. I lived here most of my life. I went there for the first time maybe like 2 or 3 weeks ago. And I went to Gasworks for the first time. I live in South Seattle. All these sites are in North Seattle. And let's just say the economic structure of these areas are different. It wasn't until I was older that I went into these places. And yeah, those are, Gasworks is beautiful. I went for the first time last week. It's just beautiful, beautiful places.
Yeah. So obviously there's a large contingent of UK Seahawks fans. They've got a Facebook group, which has, I think it's over 2,000 members. The official chapter has 300 or 400 people, I think. I'm not too sure on official numbers for this year. But is it something that you were aware of before Adam slid into your DMs a few days ago, or is it something that the team are aware of and are open to coming over here and playing in the future, do you think? Or
I don't know. Okay, so one, no, I had no idea there was this big like UK following of like Seahawks like Seahawks supporters. Absolutely not. I text my friend. It's like, yeah, I'm about to go do this thing on like in the UK. Like, wait, what? They care about football there? I'm like, yeah.
To interject, when Stephen Hauschka misses field goals on Sunday Night Football, bear in mind that's 5:30 a.m. for us, and we've been up all night.
Oh, yikes!
It's not allowed. Not at 5:30 a.m.
In terms of the Seahawks coming out there, I think to come out there, you have to jeopardize. You don't have to jeopardize, but you have to, like, you lose a home game, I believe. Like, you have to use that as one of your home games, I think. And for Seattle to do that, I don't think that would happen.
Yeah.
It would have to be, I mean, I think it'd be cool. I wouldn't get to come out there because, you know, budget. I think it would be cool, but yeah. Because apparently, like, the teams that they send out there have been bad.
Yeah,
I think the Jags
are like London's version of what Celine Dion is in Las Vegas. I think they're always here every year, and they're still not very good.
We were hoping that the Jacksonville game would be moved. The Jacksonville against the Seahawks game would be moved to London, but it hasn't happened, obviously.
The problem with like that's just such a, it's almost the equivalent of a backhanded compliment. It's like, yeah, we want to show our fans internationally how much we care. Let's send them the Jaguars. What? That's an insult. That's just mean. Send us the Packers or something every year, or a team that you know, it's the Seahawks. Yeah, a team that you know, they're probably going to be good, even if we schedule this game right now in 2013 for 2017. This team is probably going to be good, whereas we know Jacksonville probably won't be good 10 years from now, and it's, they just keep going out there. I think Cincinnati went out there right? That was
a yeah. The Giants have been out here a couple of times. The Dolphins are coming this year. Yeah, so the Saints are coming again as well. But there's only, I think, us, the Packers, and the Eagles, I think, are some of the only teams who haven't come over.
And we've got the Cardinals against the Rams as well. So we've got two NFC West teams, but not us.
Oh, boy. Cardinals. The score of that game could be 7-4. Somehow the Rams would manage to not score a touchdown, but get two safeties.
The ghost of Jeff Fisher will live on.
Oh, that's right. They don't have Jeff Fisher. I got to get new jokes. So maybe... Maybe they will have Jared Goff.
They're not going to score any points on offense.
But it's so weird. They have a lot of talent. They have Aaron Donald and Todd Gurley's good, and but it's like, oh man, they're not going to score more than 12 points today. That's very, very, very disappointing. I'm going to have to watch that game. But yeah,
we'll still find a way to lose them in the Coliseum.
Oh yeah, for sure. Sure. Seattle's good for, even with Jeff Fisher gone. I think that's a tradition that's here to stay, I think. Yeah. Personally.
Yeah. So when I think there's quite a few people, I think it's up to I think 15 plus UK guys are heading over for the Texans game, I believe it is. So when you're covering that game, just look around, they might see some green and blue Union Jacks flickering around. And obviously if you do head over to New York to cover the game at MetLife, if you just look up, you might be able to see me and Adam and a few others very, very cold in an uncovered stadium. So
I might even get you guys in our fan. We do a bunch of fan photos from games. Texans game might be one of them. Might get you guys in a few shots. You never know.
That'd be awesome. But massively do appreciate you taking your time out of your day off. Where can people, obviously on Seattle PI, but where can people get in touch with you if they want to on social media?
Twitter is probably the best one. I don't like people in my business anywhere else. So at Mike Dugar on Twitter, MikeDugar. Make sure you read the bio beforehand. I feel like people are very surprised when I talk about tennis shoes or I talk about the music that a DJ is playing. And then I tell them, go look at my bio. I give you that info ahead of time. Like this is a thing. You get Seahawks, you get sneakers, you get stadium music. This is an all-encompassing format here. So that's the main one. You'll find links to my stories there, and you'll find jokes about Eddie Lacy tackling, and then you'll find everything, all things Seahawks.
All the big stuff.
Oh, all the hard-hitting news.
Cool. Massive thanks, Michael.
I appreciate you guys for having me on. Really enjoy it.
Anytime. Hopefully we can do it in mid-season at some point as well.
Bye week, maybe. That's a good
Sounds
time.
Good.
Cool. Hey, this is John Moffitt, and you're listening to the Pedestrian Podcast. Go Hawks.
Right, massive thanks, as we said, to Michael Shawn for joining us. That was fun, that.
Yeah, I mean, we actually had people that know what they're talking about the Seahawks on the show, which is maybe, after Rob Staton, probably a first.
Yeah. They're like solar eclipses on this podcast when people talk about him. But there's some interesting stuff. As you said, you can catch you all on seattlepi.com. Seattlepi is the first port call I had when I first started following Seahawks. So with Michael Shawn and Stephen Cohen before him, it's definitely a pretty cool resource and obviously something to keep on. We will be back in a couple of weeks, as I said. On the last podcast, we'll be back after the San Diego game this weekend. You can catch us all on the Podbean, on iTunes, the Pedestrian Podcast, UK Seahawkers UK on Twitter. Myself is Stu_Court on Twitter, Adam D. Nathan, and RossBound1984. Obviously, the Facebook page as well, the Pedestrian Podcast. But until next time, this has been the Pedestrian Podcast.
Go Hawks! Nailed it.
That is going to do it. 12, they're bringing the trophy home. Your Seahawks Super Bowl 48 champions.